Awaaz.com.
We did a little research and discovered that 99% of the people are telling us, why doesn't Rediff.com give us an email service? So I hired a couple of programmers, sat down and wrote the code and built the original Rediff Mail, which today has over 109 million users.
Wow.
Rediff Mail was in the market and Google started the email 8 years later.
Welcome to Pathbreakers on Awaaz.com. I'm your host, Upendra Naburi. Today, we're privileged to have Ajit Balakrishnan, widely known as the father of the Indian internet industry. Many of you listening in on this podcast would be familiar with the term lightning mail. And sitting right before us today is a gentleman right behind lightning mail and many other wonderful innovations in India. He hails from a very simple background from Kerala, from a family of doctors and medical professionals. But lo and behold, at a ripe age of 22, he set up Rediff Fusion, the advertising agency, with two other legendary figures. And why this is important is he did this at an age and time when startup wasn't as romantic as it is today, and being an entrepreneur was anything but romantic. Then in 1995, he set up the legendary Rediff.com. He possibly set up and conceptualized the Indian industry and the dot-com as we know it today. It's evolved leaps and bounds. He's an alumnus of IIM Calcutta, and extremely interesting that he also went on to become the chairman of the board of governors of IIM Calcutta much later on, where he spent over 10 years, and much to talk about on that as well. So on that note, Ajit, a very warm welcome to Pathbreakers. It's a privilege and a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm sure it's fun to talk to you.
All right, Ajit, to kick this off, what inspired a young man from Kerala to come in and set up an advertising agency at a raw age of 22, when being an entrepreneur is possibly considered taboo in India?
Okay, I'll tell you this. When I was in the second year of IIM at Calcutta, I had to decide, you know, what everyone was very focused on, joining Hindustan Lever and Citibank and so on. Somehow, I couldn't reconcile life of that kind. Because you remember when you mentioned that my father was a doctor, and he was a doctor in independent practice. It is a kind of entrepreneurship,
yes,
which is different from trading entrepreneurship. A doctor as an entrepreneur, his success depends on his knowledge of medical science and the way you deal with your patients and help them. So in my head, an entrepreneur was just that, you know, modeled on my father.
Absolutely.
And you'll be shocked to know my grandfather was a doctor as well.
Wow.
Not to mention my grandmother. So, you know, and they all ran hospitals, and that is entrepreneurship, but not of buying for 10 rupees and selling for 15 rupees type of entrepreneur. So though I did get offers from all the usual, you know, Tata, et cetera, I took this courageous decision to come to Bombay, because Bombay then and now was the center. And advertising then was, it is not advertising, you know, Rediff Fusion is founded as a place where you could create brands. You know, advertising has become a sing-song thing of late. But at that time, the real challenge was chemistry had developed so much that anybody could make a toothpaste. Anybody could make a soap or a detergent. So product-based differentiation was not possible.
Right.
So you had to find some concept which will help differentiate your product from others. So in America in the 60s, they thought up the idea of brands, the concept to differentiate what had become commodities. You know, that TV series Mad Men quite accurately portrays that event. So both Arun, Nanda, and I, when we founded that place, and Muhammad, we were in the age of, I was 21, 22, and they were just 4 or 5 years older than me. We knew analytical things. We knew market research. We knew brand strategies. At a time when in Bombay, running an ad agency or competition were all people in the English language theater, you know, if you remember.
Yes.
Alec Fathamsi and all of them acted in place. And so I thought it was quite exciting and fun.
Okay, I'm curious. So you said you did get offers from other companies. So I'm very curious, if life had taken another twist and you didn't form Rediff Fusion, which company do you think you may have actually joined back in those
days? I can't see myself working for anybody then or now. You know, I did not know the reason why for a long time. But, you know, intuitively, when your father is a doctor who runs his own hospital and your grandparents run their own hospital, you feel that knowledge-based business where you're independent is the way to be, intuitively, without even a discussion of it.
Right.
I think that must have played a role in my head.
Yeah? Okay. Finding co-founders is a very important aspect of entrepreneurship. You've teamed up with Arun Nanda and Mohammed Khan, two legendary figures in themselves. If I may ask, how did you meet both
of
them?
Well, none of us were legends at that time.
Of course.
All of us were equally unknown. So become legends much later in your 40s.
Right.
But we, three of us, met. I joined the most creative ad agency of that era called MCM. And I joined them because I loved the work that they were doing, the outstanding creative. So I came from Calcutta and knocked on the door and got myself a job, you know. And then as part of sprucing up MCM, because half of me was management student guy. So together with Kersi Kathrak, we went and hired Arun from Levers.
Wow.
And we went and hired Mohammed, where Mohammed was working as part of Sylvie DeCuona's outfit those days. Yeah? Arun, incidentally, is from IIM Ahmedabad. Not many people know that.
Huh? Already?
Yeah, he is.
So what is your sales pitch to Arun and Mohammed?
Oh, God, no. I think it is my sales pitch then and now is not a very loud one. You describe a common cause and you,
sure.
That's, you know, and people join the cause. That's it.
Okay. And a few decades later, you set up Rediff.com,
yeah.
Which is an iconic brand in the Indian context today. And I must ask you, what was that thought?
What led? Okay, what, I'll tell you what led. You missed a period in between, but somewhere the personal computer arrived in the world somewhere in the 80s, 88, 89, 85.
Those are the days of Commodore and all
correct.
Those brands.
And that's I was very excited because most people don't know this, at IIM Calcutta, we were obliged to learn Fortran programming.
Okay.
Obliged. So I was a very good Fortran programmer as well, if you're talking of 45 years ago.
That's right.
And they were very mathematically oriented, so things like Markov chain processes, I knew. And just the other day, this came up in the office, and my direct reports are, many of them are IIT grads who are in their 20s. And one of them says, sir, there's a new technique we should try called Markov process. It came back. I told him, Kiro, this is how you do it. And they looked at me astonished and said, how do you know this, sir? I said, I learned this 45 years ago. So in that sense, so I went and bought a share and worked, rather headed a company called PSI Data Systems in Bangalore.
Oh, I see.
And okay. We were building computers. We were actually manufacturing computers there. This, you're talking of 87, 88.
So you had left Rediffusion, the agency,
no, I told
or you had
Arun,
that running?
No, no, I told Arun, you worry about this. Okay, I'll come Monday to Friday, I'm in Bangalore.
Okay.
And Friday mornings, I'll come and make sure that, you know, things like financial stuff and all that I'll worry about.
Yeah? All right.
So that's it. So I used to commute to Bangalore in that 86, 87 period. Every day, and I was very actively involved. And when the market turned, we sold that company to somebody else.
Okay.
And I came back and I saw the internet coming. One foot of mine was in media and the other foot was in computers.
Right.
Then you see the internet coming very quickly because you're standing at that crossroads.
That's right.
See? Yeah.
Wow. Okay. I didn't know this part of the hardware journey.
Yeah, I know.
So you were doing creative campaigns and you were designing circuit boards at the same time.
Well, I didn't have to design circuit boards
Assemble
as much
them.
As just telling them what product features to put in.
Got it.
My partner, Vinay Deshpande, and others were from the Stanford. They're all both Stanford computer science guys, then and now.
Okay. So when you set up Rediff.com, India was extremely, even nascent would be a very generous word.
India had 21,000 internet users, and I knew them all by name. Yeah, we hired 800 square feet near the fort.
Okay.
The main reason being it had to be next to VSNL.
That's right.
So, you know, VSNL services are very basic, very
right.
basic. So, yes, India had 21,000 users, of which 19,900 were Indians in America. Yeah,
okay.
that was the origin. So when we came online, we all knew each other at that time. Yeah.
And when Rediff.com started, what was the first avatar which went on? It was a content play?
I tell you what is interesting, because I was interested in media then and now, I hired a few people, Nikhil Lakshman still with us,
right.
A few people, and we created a news bulletin type thing on the web, but we quickly realized all our users are in America, so it was always catering to the NRI thing.
Got it.
Now, 6 months into it, I said, let me go and decide. We did a little research and discovered that 99% of the people are telling us, why doesn't Rediff.com give us an email service?
That's right.
So I hired a couple of programmers, sat down and wrote the code and built the Rediff mail, the original Rediff mail, which today has over 109 million users today.
Wow.
So I helped in the conceptualizing of the product and writing of the software, and we launched it. So soon we realized that people come to check the mail and then stop to read some other things on the side. That's communication is a core feature of the internet, even today.
Correct.
Instant messengers, the current hero is WhatsApp.
Yes.
Essentially a communication tool, and then you add a layer of media on top of it. That's the way it is. That's how the internet works.
And I must ask you this. Many of the things which you introduced into the market, whether it is fast mail, some of the content, the messenger service, quite a few of the elements in the stack, you were pretty much the first or one of the first in India. And with due credit, you possibly made the category and made the market in India. Unfortunately, for most innovators, when you are making the market, as I say, the first to come through the gates, they're the bloodiest. They really need to go through it.
Another way of saying is pioneers always have arrows on their backs. that's an American saying, yeah.
That's right. So tell me, when you look back and you've really like changed stuff, you've made stuff, you've changed stuff, it must be really tough. How is the life of an entrepreneur, an innovator?
Didn't see it as tough at all then or now. It is fun. But, just to mark the period, we started, Rediff Mail was in the market and Google started the email 8 years later.
That's right.
8 years later.
You had Sabir, who just launched, I think, a few years
Sabir before. Had Hotmail.
Hotmail,
a few
that's
months
right.
before us. A few months. Months, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think, so we were quite early.
Right.
And people have always asked me then, why didn't you flip your company and go to the United States? Because that's where all the action is. But I, again, I'm not one of those guys seeking to escape from India. I think India is where you are, and and this is where you play. Doesn't matter. Even today, India's internet user base is relatively small compared to else.
Sure.
Because the PR officers of various companies exaggerate the number of internet users. But the investments are being made to make it big. So I think, but the life of an entrepreneur is not tough. It is fun and exciting.
Okay.
I've never seen it as being tough at all.
Wow.
I like to work hard. Like today I woke up at 4 a.m. I get up at 4 a.m. every day. And nowadays I'm very impassioned about mastering deep learning technique and computing science like artificial intelligence. So every morning I write code from 4 to 6:30 every morning.
You're serious?
Even today, including today morning.
Wow.
Right. So I think it's fun. It's discovery, excitement of a new world. Like right today, for example, I'm most excited by the immense possibilities of transfer learning, deep learning. All of it in the media is hyped up as artificial intelligence. But those of us who are in it call it deep learning.
That's right.
Immense possibilities, immense.
You were also one of the first off the block for e-commerce in India.
No, not one of the.
The first.
That again, yeah, correct.
Then you had players who came in at a much later stage, several years later. When you went through the gates and came out first to set up e-commerce in India, what did you think you should have possibly done differently now that you look back at it?
I must say that the way the internet has evolved in the last 3 or 5 years is not what any of us, the early founders, wanted it to be. And Tim Berners-Lee will agree with me, because And the reason is, we all saw the internet and the World Wide Web as a way for human beings to cooperate for the greater good of themselves.
That's right.
Very idealistic. And for example, in my head, e-commerce, online shopping was a method of helping connecting the small shop, the kirana shop, with consumers.
Right.
It was not a way to import things from abroad and sell it at such a low price that all the kirana shops are bound to close down. That was never the intention.
Okay.
That was not the intention which the web was created.
All right.
So it went off into a direction driven by the greed of bankers, investment bankers, that's all I will say. And I said this recently at a conference in New York, and many of them clapped, you know, it's true. And I'm pretty sure in the next 2, 3 to 5 years, the internet and the World Wide Web will return to its idealistic origins. It is a way of helping a small shopkeeper connect to consumers. It is not a way of, you know, importing things or subsidizing it, where your e-commerce company makes a 10,000 crore loss and you say you have a market capitalization of 20,000 crores. You know, that is not what it is meant to be. So I'm one of those folks who believes in the idealistic vision of the internet and what it can do for human beings.
So Ajit, since you picked on that, I'm going to take this a little further. And it's a subject very close to my heart. If you were to look at the internet, right, as a backbone, right, it's like an infrastructure, so to speak. A few centuries back, you had the railroads. Then you had oil. Then you had the electric grids. Yeah. In a different realm, the internet is kind of the wheels. It's the backbone, right? And pretty much in any infrastructure driving element, you have had very large corporates operating in those space. So if you see North America, you have the Rockefellers. In India, we can name a few when we talk about oil and gas and so on. So if I were to kind of challenge you on the dimension of having large corporate being present in a space, I'm not touching on the profitability aspect of it. I'm just going to keep it aside. Wouldn't it be natural if you were to see the last 3 centuries of human evolution and industrialization? Why should we be surprised or have a reaction which is different when we do see large corporates emerging on this infrastructural bed of the internet?
Now, if you mean the telecom infrastructure, there is a case to be made that 2 or 3 or 5 will dominate it, you know,
sure.
The infrastructure.
Right.
Just as electricity generation tends to be that,
that's
electricity
right.
distribution tends to be that.
Correct.
But services which are offered because of that, you know, the internet is like that. It's like having the electric light.
Yes.
If you did not have it, you can't do anything else. But you can't say, thereby I will price my electric light so low that all other people will go out of the way. So the internet will, you know, it will come back to its origin as a piece of infrastructure, as you really pointed out.
Okay.
And services which work off it are different.
Sure.
Like e-commerce or, you know, communication services like instant messaging or news services.
That's right.
But it'll return. I'm very confident it'll return to its idealistic origins. It'll take 2 or 3 years to correct that. Lots of people are discussing and debating this, you know.
Right. And then if I were to take you on the dimension of the profitability or the huge losses which are being made.
Yeah.
And then we see Amazon after a couple of decades. Yes, they did take an extremely long time. They had very patient investors and capital, whichever way you look at it. But I would imagine they have reached that state where they are making some money. Yes, there are schools of thought where you're saying that the cloud is the one which is making a ton of money for them. Core e-commerce is still not making money. So I am with you when we look at it in a slightly more, I would not say cynical, but more critical of companies making tons of losses. But should we also be hopeful of the fact that maybe if we give this a couple of decades, yes, these businesses will evolve and make profitable?
It depends. I think a lot of this mischief, I call it mischief, is created by the financial community, originated in America, but now it's spread even to India. So I think it's just madness. I'm very familiar with all of them. Many of them are friends of mine and I keep talking to them. But I think the goal of entrepreneurship is not necessarily become the richest man in the world. It can't be.
You know, I understand.
I think at a later stage in today's chat, you know, there's questions which arise when you are 60 or 70 that, you know, you look back to your life and said, you know, have I lived it the right way?
Sure.
Now, whether you have 10,000 crores in your bank or whether you have 20 crores in your bank, it doesn't really matter. It matters on what you have contributed to society in some basic way.
Of course.
Have you improved the lives of people in some basic way? So I come from one of those idealistic backgrounds, being a father and a son and grandson of doctors, and coming from Malabar, which tends to be, you know, very much socialistically oriented. You know.
Okay, I really don't think, I wouldn't think it's being old-fashioned or anything. And these are conversations which one has, and I think these experiences are shared increasingly by a larger number of people in a younger age group as well nowadays.
Yeah.
And it's just not those people who've achieved kick-ass bank balances, but these are generally people who become more societally aware. And I think dialogues and conversations by people like you is helping drive that thought further. And I think it's giving them a sense of belief and comfort, so to speak, yeah. saying that they're not totally off their rockers, but yeah. saying, hey, I really want to do something sensible as well. So,
yeah, you know, at the core of some of these problem creators is this thing called the ideology of saying shareholder wealth maximization is the goal of every entrepreneur. I said, I don't believe it.
Okay.
I said that in a Wall Street conference. It can't be. Well, shareholder wealth maximization is not the goal of a business. You know, consumer welfare maximization is the role of your business. And they all clapped. I told them, guys, you're clapping for me. Why didn't you write editorials to this viewpoint in the Wall Street Journal?
And follow it through on your yeah. next investment decision.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that you picked up the societal aspect of it. In the last couple of years, you've seen there are organizations who are making deliberate efforts to be more environment friendly, having sustainability goals. The financial markets have come around and said, hey, we're going to start issuing green bonds. These are still little specks going around, but one can see that there is possibly a movement arising. Now, you, of course, have been in India. You have listed in the US, so you're, of course, exposed to many other geographies. Is this thought dominant enough? Do you see enough people and organizations getting more societally oriented and responsible? Or is this just one nice little thing to say in the media and let me go ahead and do what I want?
I suspect that the green movement and the anti-carbon movement is, I think, has truly taken roots. And you can see the electric car, for yeah. example, is and cars which are semi-autonomous in their driving, which that means older people can safely drive without crashing. All these is about to revolutionize the car industry, the auto industry. It implies that that is finally come of age. You know, some of these things take, and the electric car and environmental sensitivity around the automobile can make such a big difference, such a big difference. There is a theory which is about to become policy in New York, in Manhattan,
okay.
where they discovered that 40% of the space of Manhattan is taken up by parking lots.
That's right.
Now, if you made parking lots, tax them very high, and that 40% becomes 5%, the authorities are saying, we promise to convert this into parks. What a wonderful life that would be for the little children in living in Manhattan. You know, so that movements are about to start. And I think Bombay is a case in point. I think we. So I think these idealistic movements exist. It's not that they will go away.
Okay. Recently, I came across in North America, there is a new housing project which has been started off where the headline is No Cars Allowed. So actually, they're creating an entire housing complex, grounds up, imagining a world where there are no cars.
Yeah.
And so, yes, those sparks have started. And the reason I've shared this is, what would be your advice to senior entrepreneurs or even leaders in the corporate world who do have a responsibility to shareholders, right? How do they take on the subject of saying, hey, let me do something which is either doing it right from a sustainability or an environment standpoint, or what can I do to make me more relevant and positively contributing to society? What's a conversation which a leader should be having with a member of the board or the shareholders to start steering that conversation?
I think some of it depends. Now, you can see in India, if you see the top 20, 30 big giant companies, they are all into things like mining coal or mining oil or making cars. So for them, it's a tough discussion to have because much of it is your profit, you maximize by just throwing things around and just shipping things and making a profit.
Right.
But it's more likely, for example, the Silicon Valley area, the tech entrepreneurs are innately very, very concerned with things like this.
Yes.
Because their businesses do not necessarily spoil the environment. So I think it'll happen with time. People are getting educated. I'm very optimistic. Yeah.
Okay. And any tips for them? How can they start creating those conversations and moving the needle? What would be your advice to a leader?
In sustainability?
Yes. If a leader has to have a discussion with a member of the board or the shareholders saying, I'm willing to drop my ROE by 2%, but let me do something which helps the environment, helps make me more carbon neutral. Delta today announced that they have a $1 billion plan to basically try and become carbon neutral in the coming 10, 15 years. So there's something which, I'm not saying Delta is doing it right or what will happen, but there is some conversation, something which his leaders have started saying, and the shareholders are saying, hang on, maybe this guy is talking sense.
I think it needs not just the founding leader to talk. I think NGOs have a role to bring some of these things up. Media has a role to, you know, portray the success stories of such ventures. In other words, the Indian society as a whole has to buy into it. Don't make that poor entrepreneur the sole responsible man for this kind of action. And I think it's everywhere. NGOs are sprouting up on the green cause.
Okay.
So I'm optimistic. Don't worry. Just wait 2-3 years and you'll see much more action.
Then I'm hopeful.
Yeah.
Followed by optimistic, I'm totally hopeful and we desperately need it. If you don't mind, I'm going to take a little latitude on this one.
Okay.
So at one end, we are saying the internet is very important. It can move and weave itself into a different avatar. At the other end, when you start seeing industry reports, where they start saying in a couple of years, data centers are going to be consuming 30% of the global electricity. It's some number like that.
Yeah.
So as a society, if we step back, isn't there something, how do you manage this? At one end, you're saying internet is important. And at the other end, you're saying this is going to be the next electricity guzzler.
Yeah, it's true. It has to do with we need to spend more time to improve the technology such that it doesn't guzzle so much.
Sure.
It's going to happen. It's, again, lots of people are investing time and money because people have a selfish reason. In the internet industry, your bandwidth and costs are nearly almost match the cost of your employees. So everyone's working on very, very hard to see how technology can be brought to bear. Some of it has to do with, like, you know, all the data centers in Bombay, all the big ones which have been, I know intimately, every square foot of it. The biggest cost is electricity.
That's right.
Because Bombay power rates are very high. But on the other hand, Bombay power doesn't flicker out like in Calcutta and in Delhi and even in Bangalore. So they all love having data centers here. Plus the international cable lands here, you know, the big one lands here in Bombay. But I think lots of people are addressing how to make it less power intensive.
Okay.
You know, it is possible. It is possible. I think some breakthroughs will come soon.
Right.
Because so many bright minds are working on this problem.
So as a takeaway, possibly for a leader in a technology company who does want to do something which is more environment friendly or something relevant,
yeah,
maybe that's an area that they should start exploring.
Well, that is just one. There is an equal amount of concern and anxiety about things like artificial intelligence and deep learning can cause damage as well. You must have heard the debates about fake news and, you know.
Yes.
So, as I told you, I wake up at 4 a.m. and write code. I tried experimentally to write or create pictures. You can do astonishing things. You know, you can fake a person's novel by feeding in half of a novel of Dickens.
That's
the, the algorithm learns it and it spews out the second half. At the moment, I'm enjoying the intelligence of all this. But, you know, there are people have pointed out this kind of technology could be put to negative use in many ways. Fake news is the most classic example being pointed out. So, but it's okay. Every technology comes with some negatives. Now, for example, the first industrial revolution in England, which made cotton cloth very cheap by using electric looms and steam-supported looms and spinning machines. Also, that's the time when we had maximum child labor.
Yes.
The people who were employed in those British mills were all 12, 13, 14-year-old babies. And pollution, the coal, many of them were run by steam and coal from there was thrown out in the open. But it is not to say that, but it produced cheap cloth, which allowed for the first time many people in India to wear cloth. You know?
That's right.
Yeah. So each technology comes with some negatives, and society must find the balance in that.
It's interesting that you're saying that society should find the balance, right? If you're looking at the internet, if you look at artificial intelligence, if you look at the entire area of genomics and genetic hacking. So at one end, we're seeing a bunch of these new amazing emerging technologies, which can really do amazing stuff for the quality of life, for safety, for education. Each and every one of them has a darker conversation subject around it. Then at the other end, we say everything should start evolving in a fairly open framework. It shouldn't be bound within a regulatory body. Then there's a conversation on the roles of government. So at one end, we're saying everything should flourish. Everything should be open. Everything should basically pollinate, grow, mature into whatever shape it takes. And then at the other end, we ourselves say, hang on, someone needs to be sitting out here and saying, what's a good boy? What's a bad boy in this? How is this going to work out?
No, you don't need to have some God saying what's right and what's wrong. Society has a way to do that. I think particularly in India, I know that five Indians will have seven views on any topic. But I think society will find a way to regulate. I don't think we should depend on governments or on some wise men to say what is good and what is not good.
Do you believe corporates or even NGOs have an appreciation of self-regulation? Is it there in the DNA?
Society balances it not by self-regulation as much as by, you know, particularly in this country, we argue and talk and we fight and throw stones and of late throw knives and all that stuff. But the rest of us are watching and finding a balance, you know. All these horrible things were going on in Delhi, which leading to, in my humble opinion, lots of Indians are thinking that we assume that we have become a safe and sane society. But watching things in Delhi, we have to be more careful and make sure that those kind of, you know, we're learning. We're learning at the same time as we feel sad for things which have, you know, people affected there. The society has the ability to self-correct itself, I think.
So you're still a firm believer in society being able to find its balance?
Yeah, I think so. We've seen this in this country.
Okay.
Last 60, 70 years, all kinds of, we've been through Naxalism, oh God, what have we not seen? Famines. Oh God, I can't think of all the bad things that have happened in the past.
So I have huge respect for you because you've set up shop in India, several businesses in India, where most people would have said, hey Ajit, take the next flight to JFK. That's where you should be doing business, right? And you're a proud Indian. Is there something of a formula? Is there an Indianness to doing business in India?
No, I don't chew pan or spit it out. So I'm disqualified for that. No.
No, sure.
It's not doing business in India is different from doing business in America or England.
Okay.
Companies like ours, Rediff.com and Rediffusion, the internal culture could be anywhere, you know,
right.
Silicon Valley and so. There are traditional Indian businesses too. We have to, you know, that's different. But I think in India, in Bombay and Bangalore,
right,
and to some extent Delhi, and to a smaller extent, and Madras, and to some extent Calcutta, current contemporary companies are there. The way they deal with their staff, the role of women, all of that is pretty much like in, you know, San Francisco or, you know, Santa Clara or New York City. So I don't see. Because there are many things you must do. For example, Rediff.com has deep, because of our email business, for the last 20 years, very deep insights into cybercrime, cybersecurity. And when authorities are befuddled, our own even defense and police are befuddled, they call us and say, Ajit G. They all call me Ajit G. So I tell them, do I look that old, guys? You know. So they come.
No, you don't.
No, they come and talk to us, and we try to help them.
Right.
So India needs that expertise as well.
Okay.
You know, one part is to run a business. The business has expertise in it. I think socially fulfilling as a good middle-class boy, I feel happy to be able to help the Indian Army on some specific things. I feel it's a duty to help.
Is this because Ajit is actually a true Indian at heart? And what does Ajit say to all those people who come cribbing to him saying, "Yaar, doing business in India, God, it's like impossible. I'm packing my bags and heading off somewhere."
Well, nobody's said to me that. But
I wouldn't say impossible, but say it's much tougher.
I know there are indices of difficulty of doing business, so ease of business, all that. My thing's all nonsense.
Okay.
No, India has problems of some kind.
Sure.
Like America has problems. In the middle, I went for about 2 years and experimented living there, not for any other thing. I wanted to understand how Wall Street worked and meet them and friends, and law, the legal system and all that. They have their challenges as well, which are different from ours. In India, the main challenge in practically any industry that you do, media, as you guys are, or internet, is markets are very small. The consumer purchasing power is relatively small compared to China or the United States or Europe. So that's an ongoing battle. But on the other hand, people are so nice here. People are nice in America too, but I don't mean that. But I think you get very talented people at one-tenth the price in India.
Right.
There are advantages to being in India.
Being Indian is also about a plurality and multiplicity of everything that we do, be it the language, be it the cuisine, the religions and everything. Reed of Mail was also one of the first to start off in different Indian languages.
Yeah.
Most marketeers and business leaders talk about saying, hey, India is much more than English.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it remains at headlines. Many advertising copies are still transliterations and not true generic coming in from the soil, Lucknowi Hindi, as you'd like to see it. Where is the gap? I mean, everyone clearly sees it that there is an opportunity of engaging consumers in a more relevant manner in languages beyond English. But somehow we are not just seeing...
But has it not happened in the media, Hindi language media, television? No?
Hindi is possibly yes.
Tamil, it is, definitely. Malayalam, 110%.
Sure. So let me step back. I'm not talking about media. What I'm actually talking about is when you look at products as an example.
Example of a product?
An email service.
Ah, that's a service. Okay. Yeah,
right?
Service.
So services like that. Many products and services which are still launched in India is still pretty much with an English-first mindset. The communication of those products when you're looking at advertising. This is my view, and I would love to stand to be corrected on this. When you look at the entire PR approach, which many corporates do, at least I haven't noticed as much original thinking saying, hey, let me create a communication suite, thinking from a Tamilian consumer perspective. Let me look at their entire service suite. But if you're seeing it really happening, great. But
I think it is this would have been a valid criticism about 20 years ago.
Okay.
But today, I don't follow the Hindi medium papers at all. But when I go to Kannur, which is my hometown, for 7 days each in Onam, Vishu and New Year, I'm there with family always for the last 50 years. And at that time, when I read the local papers, Madhubhumi or Malayala Manorama and so on, they are very current and they are very national and international. So I think it exists. Though some of us have become sahibs, in English-speaking sahibs. But that is fast changing. Rediffusion's biggest success as an ad agency first came from launching Hindi commercials.
All right.
Yeah. Real breakthroughs we came and Kamlesh Pandey was a creative director. Oh, God, he created some outstanding stuff. Yeah.
If you were to look back in your long, illustrious career, which would be those two or three turning points to your mind where you thought, hey, I've got this, now I've stepped it up, or you just say, wow?
I think I'm right now in the middle of one, as we speak. And I'm absolutely fascinated by the potential for, deep learning, machine learning, artificial intelligence, and for the benefit it can do to society.
Right.
I'll give you an example, which I'm experimenting with, that, today legal services are very slow in India. There's something called the Court of Small Causes in Bombay. If your two merchants have a fight about an amount less than 10,000 rupees, you have to go there.
Yes.
And your case won't be heard for 11 years. So what do we do as businessmen? You hire a gunda and you beat up the other guy and get the money. One of the projects, my dream project, and please don't laugh when I tell you this, when I get the software breakthroughs, which may be a few months from now, we'll have kiosks, like ATMs all over. If two merchants fight, they go in front of a legal kiosk, ATM, put 100 rupees, speak their own versions, their judgment will be printed out to be implemented. So really, and I'm working on a project which with great amount of success so far. If you name the Supreme Court bench and give me a text of the plaint, I'll predict with 90% accuracy what the Supreme Court will decide using machine learning. And this is what I do from 4 in the morning to 6. And the reason for doing this is, you know, in a democracy like India, courts taking forever to decide, you know, is what leads to gangsterism and others.
That's right.
We need quick service. It is almost like taking money out of ATM.
Yes.
You go and stand in front of it and say what you have to say, you'll give an answer. So I feel that at the age of 71, I'm starting at 4 in the morning, but I go to sleep at 8:30. I haven't told you that. Every night I go to sleep at 8:30. And this is exciting. I think a new life is about to dawn for me and for the world.
So, Ajit, if you were given $1 billion today and said, hey, place your bet, what would your bet be on?
First of all, I can easily raise $1 billion by taking one flight to New York. So it's not such a mystery for me. But I don't think money buys anything.
Got it.
It is not money which is, you know, it is the time to do it and the current projects I'm working on, deep learning, it is just brain power and commitment and finding the right 25-year-old boys and girls who are deep into computer science. It is that. Money means nothing. Money buys you nothing, I can tell you that.
If I had to rephrase it, the areas which would excite you? Legal services is clearly you're saying.
Health services.
Health services.
If you're today a rickshaw driver, and I know some of them, and I walk around Colaba and make friends with all these creatures, and if they have a cold, they don't go and see a doctor because the doctor will, in South Bombay at least, will charge a minimum of 500 rupees.
That's right.
And he can't afford it. So whereas the calculations that I and my friends are doing, and a diagnosis becomes super cheap. For 5 rupees, you can do it. Or life medical insurance. Today, it's too expensive. None of our auto rickshaw drivers have any medical insurance. Anything happens to that guy, his family is gone. Medical insurance can be made to be no more than 5 rupees a month and protect him. So there are the biggest opportunity that deep learning and artificial intelligence is holding for us is services will become very cheap.
Okay.
Okay. Now, what it'll do to the doctors and lawyers is another story. But, you know, I think the consumer, at least from health insurance, diagnosis of diseases, speeding up justice, there are immense possibilities.
Wonderful. I think what would be great is a couple of moments on the early journey of Rediff.com. Okay. So, when you had 21,000 internet users, anything specific you want to talk about on that?
No, it was one 800 square feet room in the Fort area, and there were 2-3 programmers. And it was fun. It was not clear what the design of a future email system will be. So, it was fun to sit down and write the code and test it and make it. Because till then, it was very secretive. Nobody would tell you.
Right.
And doing those technical breakthroughs was fantastic.
Okay.
What will be the business model? Nobody knew. When you go back to 93, 94, nobody knew what the business model will be, whether there'd be a business at all.
That's right.
Some of my well-esteemed investment banking guy friends and all, but, you know, all our IIM friends are all head of McKinsey and head of this. They also look at me and say, Ajit, you're a sensible guy. What is wrong with you chanting internet, internet? Have you out of your mind? People have told me that.
Okay. So, Ajit, I'm going to touch upon clearly your areas of passion currently. You've mentioned AI, you mentioned deep learning. A lot of this has a lot of stuff to do with data.
Yeah.
And the entire subject of data and privacy.
Yes, big issue, very big issue. Yes.
What's your take on the subject of data privacy?
I think lots more time and energy has been spent on it. I think the Europeans are taking the lead on it because they've enacted laws already, very strict data laws on how much of the action behavior on the internet can be tracked and stored. India is thinking deeply. I'm involved in some of those government discussions. I think it's very important. Otherwise, the internet will get discredited because we start predicting, you know, things which are rather using personal data. Absolutely. I think there's great amount of work. But it's a work in progress. We don't know yet what to say no to and what to say yes to.
Yes.
You know, because if you say no to, it'll be like a dictator saying, you know, you can't, nobody can speak. You know? The dividing line is not yet technologically and socially clear.
The next area I want to touch upon is education. Of course, you served as the chairman on the governing board for IIM Calcutta for over 10 years.
And I also served on the National Advisory Board of Education for 10 years.
Wow.
And I, in this current new education policy, I chaired the committee, the MHRD committee, on figuring out the link between education and entrepreneurship. And my report is reproduced verbatim in the National Education Policy. So I'm quite deep into this.
Awesome. So if I were to ask you, entrepreneurism is here to stay, thankfully so, right? I don't think it's any more about being a novelty or a fashion. It's clearly here to stay. In that context, what are some of the key things that the education system needs to be doing to stimulate the entire entrepreneurial journey and making them capable of going down that journey for students?
Well, some of it is to make sure that, you know, in India, about 7 million college students graduate every year.
I see.
7 million, you know, that's the size of many countries. Graduate every year.
All right.
And of that, about 60% are in arts subjects.
Okay.
You know, English and, you know, BCom and things of that kind. My report recommends, and I'm trying, pushing them hard to, but government is easy to be distracted with some daily riots and this and that. I keep pushing them and saying, let's make sure that in the syllabus of most colleges, whether you're BCom or BA, you teach our students enough material so they won't be lost in the internet era, which is here. So I've even started framing syllabuses and so on. They're all bought into the idea, but implementing things in a democracy of our size is not easy. For example, education is a state subject. And if you have to say Kerala has to implement any of our suggestions, you know, the Vice Chancellor of Kerala University, Cochin University, and Kannur University all have to agree, and you have to make sure they implement it. They may turn around and say, I agree, but I don't have teachers to teach them. You know, I had a very interesting experience when government pushed me against my will, but I later enjoyed it on the board of something called the NITTR, the National Institute for Teachers Training in Calcutta.
Okay.
That is in charge of all the polytechnics of the East.
I see.
So every Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I used to fly out and go to Mizoram and, you know, all those places, meet polytechnics to talk to the students to help them improve their curriculum. One minor achievement was in Sikkim, we introduced Android app development in politics, polytechnics. You know, I only edged the local leader, implemented it, local director. But things of that kind are possible, you know. And I used to sit for 2 hours and listen to all of them in the Bihar Polytechnic in Patna. They're very bright kids, you know. If we show them a little way, oh, they will fly, they will fly. I talk to kids all over the world. Wherever we go, I sit down and talk to them. And Indian kids are so bright, and they've been so much love and care has been invested on them by their parents, however poor they are, that with a little light, they start flying. So I think curriculums have to be improved.
Okay.
Investment capital needs to more freely flow. We can't depend on the U.S. bankers to come and fund entrepreneurship here. Otherwise, it'll be a backdoor entry into India, like what happened. Flipkart has become a Walmart now, you know. So people in government listen. They nod their heads and say, Ajit ji, what you're saying is correct. But implementation is very complex in a democratic country. Nobody can issue a rip and say implement. You know? So that's a struggle for us.
Absolutely. Any views on what could be done to stimulate creativity and creative thinking amongst children and students?
I suspect in India we're doing quite well on that, no?
Okay.
And it can be more, of course. I think it's done by watching creative Bollywood films, you know, or listen to radio shows like yours. Even if 10,000 youngsters listen to it, they'll hear an alternative point of view.
Yes.
I think in India, we have less of a problem on that. They argue with the parents and children. Typical household, there's squabbles going on. That's all creativity. You know, the different points of view are being expressed.
So I must ask you this. Have you always been this curious and thirsty for knowledge?
I'm sure I was, yeah. Yeah, because it's Yeah, lots of people have asked me about that, particularly in America. But I think that's the main fun of life, to discover new things.
Yeah, I can still see that glint in your eyes. It's awesome.
Yeah.
You have that childish curiosity and glint in you.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, this is a podcast, but no, I wish others could see it.
I enjoy learning new things. And I enjoy, but I told you about this 1 or 2 hour sessions I used to have in polytechnics in Mizoram and so on. You sit and listen to them. And for example, I ask them, when you finish this, what kind of jobs would you guys like to do? In which city? Half of them will say, right here, you know, in that same town. Then I ask them, no, outside you have to go. No, Delhi, no, they all call us Chini. Then I said, Bombay, where I am practically my hometown, they say it's too expensive. They all vote for Bangalore and Madras.
I see.
Because they are treated equally.
Yes.
And which is true. And which is cheap enough for us to afford. You know, so you discover these things only by sitting and talking to them. No?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I imagine you like cutting chai as well.
Yeah, that's a Bombay.
All right, so Ajit, we have a segment called the Rapid Fire, where it's a very light conversation. Okay. It's a great way of getting to know
I hope I survived that. Okay, let me see.
It's a great way of getting to know you. And we have an Awaz tradition. Even if you give very good answers, you will not get a coffee hamper. All right, so we'll just kick this off.
Okay.
Your favorite movie?
My favorite movie, okay, in Hindi or English or any?
Whichever. Okay.
Bandini.
Wow.
Yeah, in Hindi, yeah.
Do you still keep watching it?
No, I've seen it 3-4 times in my life. And shall I tell you the reason quickly?
Please.
Why?
Would love
because
to.
I first saw it when I was in Kannur when I was 15 or 16. And I couldn't figure out. And I kept asking my mother and father, but Dharmendra is such a handsome man. Why didn't that Nutan character go with him rather than go with that old Ashok Kumar character? Yeah? If you remember that is the thing. Then they explained to me that, you know, my mother said a woman's choice of a man is not because he's old or young or rich or wealthy. I'm learning that, you see. And while she felt attracted to the young Dharmendra, who was acting as a jail doctor, I think, you know, that role. But she admired the Ashok Kumar character because he was a freedom fighter and he was unwell and she was caring for him. Those are messages which people, Hindi film, Bollywood film, in spite of their, you know, do communicate these values. So that's why it is my favorite film.
All right. And your favorite song?
Song. Oh, Beatles. Anything with the Beatles.
Okay.
And I'm jumping from Bandini to the Beatles. But they brought a creativity into music.
Right.
You know, they should have been given the Nobel Prize in Literature. They gave it to Dylan much later, I think. No? Yeah.
Yes, they did. Favorite place?
Bombay, I think. I'm a Bombay lover.
So let me take you back in time. Your first crush?
First crush was on a dog. Little pup. Truly. I fell in love with a pup. And my mother would not let me bring that pup inside the house. In Kannur, the small towns of the 1950s, dogs are to be seen and not to guard the house. That's why at home, I've always had a dog after that. We have a dog we rescued from Alibag, running around there, who sleeps in our bed between the two of us, my wife and me. He sleeps. He's a princess of the house. Oh, I should have said some woman that I had a crush on.
You can still. We are open to double crushes
as
well.
I can't think of any.
All right. If you were to look back at your life, and a mistake is a wrong word, but if you can possibly tell us, what are those 1 or 2 things which happened, which really didn't work out? And even till date, when you go back, you say, hey, maybe I could have done that differently.
You know, I must tell you this, as the entrepreneurial type that I am, every day, including today, I try 10 things, 6 will fail.
Awesome.
So, you do practically anything. You try to write a letter to Ajay Menon or a mail, and it's not perfect. I'll say I should have to do it. I could have done it better. But I think the art of entrepreneurship is to learn the art of learning from your mistakes, learn the art of failing cheaply. You must learn to fail cheaply. You know, that's a real... Because if you don't take risks, you won't discover anything new. And if you take risks of any kind, a new feature on Rediff Mail, something as trivial as that, if you don't try it, 8 out of 10 times it fails. So what we do, you create a new feature and test it in a small group of people, and then reduce the chance of failure, you know. So everywhere I see that, even in dealing with human beings.
Okay. Yeah. And on a final note, your advice to young budding entrepreneurs who are planning to set up their first venture.
Yeah, my advice would be, you know, every day they'll meet adversity, don't give up. And more importantly, learn to fail cheaply.
I love that. I'm going
to wish I could write a book on it, you know, learning to fail cheaply. There'll be, you know, on all the examples on how you can do it and what could happen and all that kind. Yeah.
I will inscribe fail cheaply somewhere for sure.
Yeah.
Ajit, it's been an absolute privilege, an honor. I'm going to run out of words to describe how it is to meet you. And I wish this podcast could run forever. I love the fact that you're still getting up early in the morning and coding it and you're hacking it. I think it's time that I started getting up in the morning. I'm terrible at coding. Wish you every success in all your endeavors, your passions. I'm sure you're going to continue doing breakthrough work. Your contributions to India have been immense. And I look forward to seeing that glint in your eyes when we meet next. Thank you so much, Ajit.
And thank you for inviting me, guys. Yeah. Okay. Right.
Thanks so much. Avaaz.com